Superchargers, headlights, and more. With over 122 million parts, eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time or your money back. Stay on your A-game with all the parts you need at the prices you want. It's easy to bring home huge wins. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. See ebaymotors.com. Superchargers, headlights, and more. With over 122 million parts, eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time or your money back. Stay on your A-game with all the parts you need at the prices you want. It's easy to bring home huge wins. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. See ebaymotors.com. It's Conrad Thompson, and you're listening to Something to Wrestle With, Bruce Pritchard. Bruce, what's going on, man? How are you?
Well, this is a big bonus episode, Conrad. I'm kind of excited because I get to revisit 1992, year in the WWE that I was only there for a couple of months. So it's pretty damn cool for me, as a matter of fact. Feeling good.
Well, I'm excited about it because this is something that a lot of people thought we could never do. We're going to cover a show where Bruce wasn't there, but it's one of the most iconic shows of all time, the Royal Rumble 1992. And I know what you're thinking.
Well, if he's not there, why are you watching it?
Well, for the same reason that you listened to podcasts about WrestleMania this last year with hosts who weren't there. The difference being here, Bruce actually was involved with a lot of this talent before and after. And this will be a fun experiment of sorts. And if you dig it, we're going to try to bring you some more because there's lots of other shows that Bruce missed. He missed WrestleMania 8. He missed Survivor Series 91. He missed Tuesday in Texas. He missed SummerSlam 91. He missed SummerSlam 92. So we've got plenty of time. Now, what was the word that Vince used? He didn't say fire.
I was on hiatus.
There you go. He was on hiatus.
Oh, God damn it. You weren't fired. Just took a little hiatus.
So hopefully we'll get to bring you those shows in the future. So if your next question was going to be, what are you covering SummerSlam 92? We don't know yet, but if this goes well, we will give you an option to get this bonus show. I want to thank everybody who subscribed to our YouTube channel. That's youtube.com/something to wrestle. Because by subscribing, we reached our milestone goal and we brought you a bonus show. And so YouTube is getting this show well before anyone else. I'm not going to say it's exclusive forever, but you got to hear it way in advance. And we really appreciate you being here. Bruce, can we start thinking about what the next milestone might be? Or is it too early?
I think it's a little bit too early, and let's give it a couple of weeks. Let it sink in and let's see how this particular show does. And then that'll help kind of get us a second milestone and we'll go on. But you know what? If they just tell their friends to subscribe, then we'll look at it and it's building and we see a lot of groundswell there. It may come a whole hell of a lot faster than everybody thinks.
I want to go ahead and mention too that we also have a podcast in case you're just listening to us on YouTube. Something to Wrestle with Bruce Pritchard is a podcast that's available everywhere you enjoy your podcasts. And I feel like I take that for granted sometimes, but we'd like for you to subscribe on iTunes or Google Play or TuneIn or Stitcher or Spotify or literally anywhere. Hit the subscribe button. Please leave us a review and, you know, 5 stars is something Bruce doesn't normally like, but we make an exception when it comes to rating our show. And of course, you can check us out on the WWE Network, at least for now, on Wednesdays. I say for now because, well, you never know. But that show is called Something Else to Wrestle with Bruce Pritchard every Wednesday on demand. It's not on the regular schedule on WWE Network, but you do need the WWE Network to get the full benefit of what we're about to do. It's the Royal Rumble from 1992. This, of course, goes down on January 19th, And we're going to cover it in long form here because it's a watch along. So fire up your WWE Network, hit your mute button. And Bruce, if you'll give us a countdown, everybody will know when to press play. And I think you're going to say 1, 2, 3 play. Is that right?
I'm going to say exactly that. I'm going to say 1, 2, 3 play. And the next time I do it, I'm going to say, here we go. 1, 2, 3 play. And we'll be ready to do it. So are you ready?
Well, it's worth mentioning. You need to let the disclaimer run ahead of it. So it's going to give you a commercial.
Yeah, good,
and it's going to give you a rating and the whole deal. Now we're in the actual show and your clock should be at 0:00. So if you're all zeroed out, we're ready for the countdown, Mr. Pritchard.
All right, guys, this one is for real. So ready? 1, 2, 3, go. It's the Royal Rumble with Jake the Snake Roberts, the Barbarian, the Model Rick Martel, the Berserker, Rowdy Roddy Piper, Hacksaw Jim Duggan, Jerry Sags, the Repo Man, Sergeant Slaughter, the alleged real world champion, the Nature Boy, Ric Flair, Hercules, Mustafa, the Macho Man, Randy Savage, Skinner, the British Bulldog, the Million Dollar Man, Ted DiBiase, Haku, Shawn Michaels, the Warlord, El Matador, Sid Justice, IRS Nikolai Volkov, the Texas Tornado, Virgil, the Undertaker, the Big Boss Man, Crank, the Hammer, Valentine, the Superfly, and Hulk Hogan. It's the Royal Rumble. It's time to rumble. It's time for the Royal Rumble.
Thank you for that. We're in Albany, New York at the Knickerbocker Arena. And what a crowd they have here. Of course, Gorilla is probably saying they're jam packed or some such. This is a show that we really can't do justice. I'm glad that it won because it's what you fans voted for on YouTube. But really and truly, you need to watch this with Bobby the Brain Heenan's commentary. Do you not, Bruce?
Absolutely. I wrote down a lot of Bobby's commentary in this, so hopefully I could try and recreate some of the gems of the brain. But Bobby was positively on his game, without a doubt. If you were ever going to listen to one Bobby Heenan commentary show, it's the Royal Rumble 1992.
Yeah, it's a really hard show for us to even compete with. So we're not going to try. We're going to try to bring you some other news and notes and just have a dialogue about the state of wrestling at the time. And maybe Bruce can drop some knowledge on us here about some of the guys in particular. But this is probably everybody's favorite Royal Rumble. To me, it comes down to this one in 1997. Would you agree with that?
I actually would agree with that. And I was a little skeptical when I started watching it, going, you know, I remembered it a little bit differently, but as it got going, I started calling spots. And when I'm calling spots in a Royal Rumble, I'm going to pat myself on the back. Then, you know, it gots to be good. Just saying.
Howard the Finkel is calling the action here. And one of the things I really appreciated about Howard Finkel is you guys just started calling him the Fink. Was Vince really big on giving everybody sort of nicknames here? Gorilla, the Fink, Weasel. It feels like everybody had even Gene Okerlund is Mean Gene. Everybody has some sort of name at the time.
Well, no, it was just, that's what we called him. We called him the Fink. And so it just kind of carried over to TV eventually. And kind of like we called these guys, the Orient Express. It's a Paul Diamond under the mask with one of the most underrated workers ever. Pat Tanaka is his tag team partner. And Pat was Duke Kayamuka's son, who one of the greatest, just the old timers from the 50s and 60s, and a new foundation. Yes.
All right. I like their theme music, but what the fuck are they wearing?
It looks like that there was a sale at the Yellow Cab Company and they just picked up some of the old uniforms there. I had to listen. Awful. God, you're going to love this. I had to listen to this again because I wrote down at first that they were the new high energy, but it was actually the new foundation, as in the new heart foundation.
Listen, new high energy, new foundation, either way, Not good. I don't know what's going on with these outfits here. Are these the worst tag team outfits of the era? Did anybody have it worse than these guys?
Well, I think Bobby Heenan had the best line of all. So he goes, wow. He goes, did Neidhart and Owens just find out about this match? Because it looks like they just woke up. What are you talking about, Brain? He says, well, they still got their jammies on.
Yeah, I mean, I can forgive the pants because they look like Sabu's pants a little bit, like an independent Sabu. However, these jackets, man, the headbands, it's hard for me to imagine Owen Hart putting on that headband and that jacket and being looking in the mirror and be like, okay, I'm ready.
You know, the funny thing about it was I remember going back with Owen and the Coco Beware stuff that Owen liked the pants look. He liked this look. So there you go.
Well, they're almost like MC Hammer pants too, which is really popular at the time. So I guess I can get behind. Talk to us about Paul Diamond. He's the guy that we don't talk about a lot here on the program.
Well, Paul Diamond broke in, and I want to say he broke in around the same time as Shawn Michaels in San Antonio. Paul was a great tag team wrestler. Paul was a hell of a worker back in his day. It just, for whatever reason, that personality, you know, that it factor, that one missing piece, I think there was always just something missing with Paul, but in the ring, he was tremendous and could do it all.
Let's talk about what's going on in the state of the business around this time. I feel like we should mention this is around the same time that Jesse Ventura filed a lawsuit against Vince McMahon, saying that the many pay-per-views and Coliseum videotapes that had his commentary on it were sold without any written agreement in place. And ultimately, he wins the lawsuit, or at least settles for a large sum of money. How did you hear about it? And did this set a precedent in wrestling?
Well, I'll tell you a funny story about how I first heard about the lawsuit. We were in Green Bay, Wisconsin, and Vince's office, it was a locker room where you walked into the locker room. There was a little bit of a hallway and a side, like another smaller dressing room. And then in the back was the big dressing room. That's where Vince's office was. I was in the smaller dressing room getting changed into my Brother Love stuff when Jesse walked in, and Jesse came in and he and Vince got into an argument. And I remember having to sit in the little small dressing room through the whole thing because I didn't want to come out so that they would know that I was there the whole time. And I just sat in there the whole time, just praying, looking at my watch going, God, would you guys finish up so I could get the hell out of here? And they finally finished up and I got out, but I pretended like I didn't hear anything. And Jesse was, you know, just that. I mean, it wasn't a heated argument, but it was Jesse being hot, saying I should get paid for this. And Vince having a different feeling, didn't think that he should.
Let me mention around here that Meltzer wrote, quote, got a copy of the current WWF death chart. So if you're interested, here's how the office ranks the guys: Babyfaces, Hulk, Macho Man, Sid Justice, Piper, Bret Hart, Boss Man, Virgil, Jannetty, Tornado, Bulldog, El Matador, Valentine, Chavis, Walker, heels, Flair, Undertaker, Snake, DiBiase, IRS, Mountie, Michaels, Repo Man, Berserker, Skinner, Warlord, Kato, Hercules. Face tag teams, LOD, Slaughter and Duggan, New Foundation, Bushwhackers. Heel tag teams, Natural Disasters, Nasty Boys, Beverly Brothers. I find this interesting for a few reasons. One, I find it really hard to believe that in this era, you guys walk around the office with a list of, here's our top guys in order.
No, and again, that's where, you know, an idiot gets a piece of paper and tries to figure out what it is. It was nothing more than a list of talent that Howard Finkel put together and that Howard Finkel put on paper so that they could go through. When you're booking, you have a list of all your talent. You scratch through it when you book someone so you know who's booked and who isn't booked. That's its purpose. List your talent.
The idea that Virgil is somehow more valuable to the company than Bulldog and Tornado made me laugh.
Because he wasn't, and it was never meant to be that way in any way, shape, or form.
It's also written, around this time, Elizabeth wasn't going to be on the road, even after being advertised. And Meltzer says he has no idea why, but then eventually a few weeks later reports that it was as simple as she was tired of the road. Do you remember hearing about that? That she was just sort of burnt out and wanted to stay home?
Well, you know, Randy Savage was one of the one of the folks I did keep in touch with, and that was it. She was burnt. And I think they both were really burnt during this time. But yeah, Liz was burnt being on the road and wanted some time just to stay home.
Around this same time, it was reported in the Observer that Chris Chavis was coming in as a babyface named Tatanka, and Charles Wright, AKA Soul Taker, was coming in as Papa Shanga, while Latin Fury got a tryout. Of course, Latin Fury was Conan in Mexico. So business may be trending down here by early 92, but man, this is some legendary talent trying to come in here, isn't it?
Pardon me. Yes, definitely. And it was also during this time that Shango was being speculated to come in, and Undertaker was pitching for me to be a manager as Brother Love of Papa Shango. Obviously that kind of fell on deaf ears, but little inside info for you there.
That would have been kind of fun to think about, a Brother Love with a Papa Shango.
I think it would have been more fun, Brother Love with the Godfather, don't you?
Oh, that would have been hilarious.
Pimping ain't easy, dog. You know what I'm saying?
Oh, Mr. Godfather, you have got to stop pimping these hoes.
And show them some more love. And just because I loved you last night doesn't mean I like you.
Or that I'm going to pay. Shouldn't men of the cloth get a discount?
Yeah, that big bastard in the ring right now needs a discount on there. Yeah, what the fuck is this? Good big rhino bastard.
Oh, what the hell?
How about the double headbutt spot there from Anvil?
You know, the one thing I've noticed about this match is Owen all over the place and everybody else bumping all over the place. Jim comes in, does a couple spots, and he's out. Who's the smart one in this group?
It big rhino is the bastard, comes in, does a couple things, gets paid the same. Fuck.
Stu kind of morphed into Triple H there for a minute.
Yeah, the big bastard. What the fuck? I don't know.
This is, I got to tell you, here's my hot take I've been promising on Twitter. This show sucks.
Which one?
This whole fucking show. Like, I enjoy the Royal Rumble 92, but it's got to be with Bobby's commentary. But if you're watching at home right now, we're ruining this show. I mean, you've got 19 fucking irrelevant tag matches, and then you've got a pretty decent little moment for Piper in a minute. And then the main event where, I mean, it's all right, I guess, but Bobby, the Brain Heenan makes it. To me, 97's my hands down favorite. This without the commentary is like cornflakes without the milk.
Well, you know what, man? See, and I went through and read some of your stuff and talking about like worst matches and best matches and things like that, which I do disagree with. There was one very easily worst match, but the matches on here are not terrible. And yes, you are missing Bobby Heenan, but by God, you've got us.
It's, I don't know. We're going to do our best. I guess I should mention here. Oh, what a shot from Mr. Fuji. Where would
Mr. Owen, he get that very, very bad shot.
Where would Gorilla say that Owen had just been hit there?
Owen Hart in the trapezius cardioid astronomical area of the Furnum Snabits.
I thought you were going to say something like the occipital protuberance or some silly shit like that.
If you do, you'll clean it up.
Around this same time, Latin Fury got a tryout match with the Juicer. So that's Conan beating Art Barr. Let me freestyle a guess here. Why do you think both of these guys didn't wind up with the company? They're both tremendous talents. And Art Barr, man, if you could have had him in 92, what could have been, right?
Well, yeah, Art Barr was a hell of a talent, but I think that Art was still pretty damn green back in 1992 and not ready for prime time. His brother Jesse might have had a little bit of baggage left in the fed, if you will. But Conan, I don't know what the hell happened with Conan. I know Conan's story was something about that he had either asked for reimbursement on something and the boys took it the wrong way and he got heat for it. I had never heard that story, but then again, I never really heard a story as to what happened with Conan and why he didn't come in, because he was hot shit in Mexico at the time, man. He was really the big dog in Mexico and drawing huge houses for AAA.
I want to mention here too, since we're talking about guys coming and going, that Meltzer wrote, Lex Luger has pretty well been confirmed as joining the WBF by several sources. Apparently they'll be running an angle with Luger entering a bodybuilding contest, and he'll get blown away by the big bodybuilding names, lose his temper, and somehow segue that into becoming a wrestler. Using Luger is as much an attempt to get wrestling fans interested in bodybuilding as anything else. Is that part of the reason you think Vince brought him in here as sort of a crossover star to introduce wrestling fans to bodybuilding?
Absolutely. Because he, you know, the wrestling fans didn't give a shit about the bodybuilders, and the bodybuilding fans didn't give a shit about the wrestlers. Lex definitely had a name in wrestling. He couldn't wrestle because of his WCW contract or NWA contract, whatever the hell it was at the time. So Vince wanted to bring him in and utilize that name power to get people watching the WBF show.
Wow. Well, how'd that work out?
Well, you know, the crazy thing was, is that Vince kind of in his own mind thought that Lex could be that WBF star to take the WBF to the next level.
He's got it. Look at him. God damn, he's a narcissist. He loves himself.
So there you have that as well. But obviously Lex didn't set the world on fire when he came in the Fed either.
Meltzer also reports in late January that Kevin Von Erich is supposed to be coming in and working the next set of TV tapings. Why don't you think this wound up happening? Why did Kevin Von Erich not get an opportunity here?
I don't know. And you know, I was at the Texas tapings that they had back in, I guess, November and what have you. And I'd never heard any rumblings about Kevin, but Kevin was set doing his thing there in Dallas. And I don't think that Kevin really wanted to work in the WWE as far as I know, but I never heard anything about it other than rumblings.
Meltzer reported in February, quote, latest on Ultimate Warrior is that those close to him say he has no interest in returning to wrestling. Of course, we know a few months from now, he's going to come back at WrestleMania 8. Here in early 92, we'll call it January. Did you have any idea that Warrior might be making a return, or was that a total last minute surprise? Most likely.
For me, that was a total last minute surprise. And from what I heard from talent that was there, it was a total surprise to the talent as well, that no one knew that the Warrior was coming back. The jury was out on Hogan, whether Hogan was staying or going, but nobody knew about Warrior coming in. Everybody thought it was all going to Sid.
They do a set of tapings in January, and they're offering tryouts to a lot of folks here, including Ron and Don Harris, which feels like from another era, but they're doing tryouts here in early 92. Billy Jack Haynes is there as well. And Brian Adams came back at those tapings simply as Crush, without any of the face makeup that we had seen before as a part of Demolition. We haven't talked a ton about old Billy Jack Haynes, and he's made a bit of a spectacle of himself in most recent years. Any good Billy Jack Haynes stories you can share with us?
You know, I guess Billy has witnessed some murders and and some different things through the years, but Billy kind of had a Heidenreich-esque aura about him, in that I don't think that people ever really felt that Billy was all the way there, and kind of kept a safe distance from him. However, when I was around Billy Jack Haynes back in the day, and just a few stints that he did coming in Houston, and I was around him a little bit in WWE, he seemed perfectly normal to me at the time.
We talked a little bit about SummerSlam 92 earlier, and it comes out in the Observer that, quote, I believe SummerSlam will be August 31st at the Capitol Center in Landover, Maryland. And this was written about a lot, Bruce, including the WWF's own magazine, but instead they wind up in the UK. Any idea why?
I think that when Vince had that opportunity to do that huge gate at Wembley Stadium, it was a way to kind of prove a point that he can do it anywhere. And it was an experiment. I think it was just something that he wanted to try and experiment, see if they could actually do and pull off. And it was a huge event for him, and obviously did real well.
Of course, we're still watching the new foundation in the Orient Express here. They're having a pretty decent match. You know, this actually got the second most votes for match of the night, according to the Wrestling Observer reader poll. Dave himself would give it 3.25 stars. They're going to go 17 minutes and 18 seconds here. And he says, Hart, who with the exception of Ric Flair and maybe Shawn Michaels was the best performer on the show, made this match along with Tanaka taking his quote, fastest bumps in wrestling, end quote. Hart did a Lucha Libre dive through the ropes onto Kato and then climbed back in the ring and pinned Tanaka with the rocket launcher. He really dug this match. When you got a chance to watch it earlier this week, what was your takeaway? Similar?
Exactly. The other thing that I kept thinking was how good Owen Hart was, especially here in 1992. Owen was good from the minute he stepped into a ring and was one of the best performers, not just in the company, but anywhere in the world. Owen was just so damn good. So I'm telling somebody this and they say, have you seen his son, Oj? And they sent me pictures of Oj that I couldn't believe, because Owen's son now looks just like Owen Hart then. Absolutely amazing. He's ripped to shreds. I don't know what the hell he's doing, but God, he's a chip off the old block when it comes to looks, and you would swear it was Owen Hart if you didn't know better.
That's good to hear, man. What'd you think of Mark Henry's Hall of Fame speech? I know you were there in person this year, so you saw everybody's speech. In his speech, he said that, you know, Martha, Owen needs to be here, and Oj needs to be around, you know, the boys and the shows. It's his birthright. Your feeling?
Well, you know, that's a real personal decision that Martha's going to have to make, and that the kids, when they're old enough, if they want to stand out on their own and they want to know more, that they can make, and they love their mom, I'm sure. And that's what they've been brought up with. So while I agree with Mark Henry's sentiments, it's not for us to say. It's for the family to say and for the kids to say. And there's another Meltzer was talking about the quick bumps of Pat Tanaka. There was a great example of that, because Pat was a bumping machine. And here comes Owen. God, he was incredible. Never stopped.
And here we go. Here's going to be our finish, the rocket launcher. What'd you think about this in an era where all the finishing moves were two man moves? What'd you think about the rocket launcher?
I thought it was, you know, I mean, it was good for them, and it kind of showcased the power of Jim and the high flying of Owen. But what made me laugh when you go back and watch it was Owen probably could have got up a whole hell of a lot higher and been more spectacular on his own instead of having to come down for Jim to launch him off. And probably telling Jim, Jesus Christ, you're stiff with that slap on the back. And you son of a bitch. Yeah. Mr. Fuji with the very special. That's a loaded cane too, by the way. You didn't know that, did you?
I did not know that. Look at it's a little thing, but just setting the cane up in the corner and have him run through it. A pretty innovative spot that we didn't see a lot of. I thought that was really cool when I watched this back.
Mr. Fuji does not get the credit he deserves for a lot of his work and even his managerial stuff. He was absolutely awesome in coming up with stuff like that. My man, hey, Fulton Lord Alfred, I'm going to do Bulldog. It's the only British accent I got.
When we did a word association with him once, you said whale rope.
Yes.
What does that mean?
A whale rope is an extremely large in circumference rope and long.
So here we see January 17th, 1992, Springfield, Massachusetts. It's clearly a house show, and the Mountie rolls up the Intercontinental Champion Bret Hart and becomes the Intercontinental Champion at a house show. And of course he starts to attack him with the belt after Hebner's having nothing of it. And it looks like we've got a bit of a situation on our hand. I hope we have a hero come out and rescue our babyface.
Well, you would certainly hope so, because this damn Mountie, it's just absolutely uncalled for. But thank God for Rowdy Roddy Piper, who's really in no big hurry to get out and save Bret. And the commentary wise, which they carried all the way through the event, was that Bret had like 102 fever.
Yeah. So the story is, I'll read this directly from the Observer. One of the stranger stories of the past week involves the Intercontinental title. Officially, as the storyline goes, Bret Hart went to the ring with 104 degree fever on Friday night in Springfield, Massachusetts, and lost the title to the Mountie. Mountie, in turn, dropped the title at the Rumble 2 days later to Roddy Piper. And as has become pretty common knowledge, as the week went on, Hart had negotiated and at one point agreed to a deal where he would debut on Tuesday, January 21st at the Clash of the Champions for WCW in Topeka, where he'd come out with the Intercontinental title as something of a payback for the WWF bringing in Ric Flair and having him wear that WCW considered their world title belt. I think a lot of people sort of forget this. I'll continue the article here. The fact that Hart was losing the title in Springfield was the world's worst kept secret, being that the WWF syndicated shows went out on the satellite on Wednesday, which means anyone with a dish would have been able to watch on Wednesday, then talk about in the past tense in detail and an angle that actually was going to occur 2 days later. It should be noted that the decision made to change the Intercontinental title from Hart to Piper was made weeks ago, before any talks had even started with WCW. So despite rumors to the contrary that are sure to be spread, it wasn't a last minute decision by Titan to get the belt off of Hart for fear he was leaving. If anything, Hart knowing he was going to lose the title may have been the impetus for his exploring the option of a jump. Apparently WCW offered Bret a guaranteed deal that was substantially more than he'd been earning as Intercontinental Champion. However, apparently after agreeing to the deal, Hart had to back out because he realized his contract with the WWF, which he thought had run out, had actually rolled over and he couldn't give his notice for several more months. However, WCW sources indicate that Hart, who had backed out on a deal as of a few days ago, will be coming in after all, not that too many months from now. Hart was promised that after losing the strap to Mountie in a house show that he would be getting it back at WrestleMania, even if it meant in a babyface match versus Piper. However, those are the kinds of promises in wrestling that aren't often kept. What'd you think here about this interesting situation that I think a lot of people sort of lose sight of, that Bret was sort of playing hokey pokey here while he was the champion with WWF and WCW?
Well, you know, I had heard from the dirt sheets and the rumor mill, because obviously I wasn't there, and I had heard, and a lot of it came from Roddy Piper, the man on the screen right now, just talking about different things. But Roddy was also friends with Bret, and he goes, you know, Bret's got a deal. I mean, he's here for a while. So I think, you know, for Piper to know and for Bret to know, I think that they knew that. It was a weird deal, and it would have been in my opinion, it would have been a big deal at that time for Bret to be over on WCW television, and that would have made a pretty good dent. But I don't know the particulars, and I don't know what the inner workings of the office were. But I had known just from talking to Roddy that Roddy was going to be the champion here at the Royal Rumble. Didn't know how they were going to get there, but I knew he was winning the title.
Of course, Meltzer, when he's comparing the situation with Flair and the WCW world title and Bret and the Intercontinental title, he writes, "Of course, the situations are completely different in that Flair was fired by WCW after the company attempted to cut an existing contract almost in half, which somehow 6 months later, WCW feels is WWF's fault for, to the extent they went to court over getting the belt off television shows. So the idea of this was to gain revenge on the WWF. But the difference is that Hart would be walking out on a valid contract." I'm fascinated by this because there's so many people who say, you know, I know we've talked about the screw job ad nauseum, but they say, "Oh, Bret would never do that." Well, when he had the Intercontinental title, he was actively negotiating with WCW.
Well, there you go. And I, you know, whether all that's true or not, I really and truly don't know. I heard the same rumors that you're reading right now, but other than discussions with Roddy back in the day, and it was more of kind of by the way, and hey, I'm doing this and I'm going to be doing that, and not getting into any details on stuff like that, was about it. You know, I mean, I talked to Roddy, I talked to Savage and DiBiase and Taker, but you know, that's how I got a lot of my information, was just guys telling me what the hell's going on in the business.
Let's talk about this match here. They're only going to go a little over 5 minutes, and Meltzer would write, "Nothing wrong with the match, but nothing much happened either. After the match, Jimmy Hart tried to zap Piper, but Piper got the zapper and zapped Mountie. I need you to go out of your way to watch this show later without Bruce and I's commentary and actually listen, because this fucking shock stick sound effect,
actually, it was worse than that.
It's way worse than that. And it's over the loudspeaker. So it's not even coming from the fucking ring. Somebody in the back where they're playing entrance music is now playing through the speakers this hokey as shit sound effect for the zapper. It's hilarious.
Yeah, it would have been, it would have had to have been good to be hilarious. It was pretty awful just listening to it and going through the whole thing, but I was prepared for it. And, Roddy's greatest damn kicks there, but it was, you know, people would often talk about what a great worker Roddy was and so on and so forth. And Roddy was, because Roddy drew money. So people can say what they want about it. He didn't do a whole lot. He did enough to draw money.
Well, and he made everything look like a fight. You know, I mean, one of the things you talked about John Cena recently is you said he did look sort of unorthodox and it wasn't all polished. And so it made it look real. It looked different. And Piper was sort of the same way to me.
Piper was different. That's what I was just going to say. I mean, Roddy was different. He was different how he sold stuff. He's different in his offense, and he made you believe. And probably a good reason is I'm watching some of those right hands. Those right hands landed and they hurt. Trust me, because I used to get a lot of them. And son of a bitch, it was just going back and doing research and people critiquing Roddy for different things. I'm going, man, you know what? That son of a bitch fought. He was a smaller guy, but yet he drew huge money and he was always there. And I'm biased because he was one of my best friends, but man, that son of a bitch got out there and fought for everything he got. He fought for.
It's worth mentioning, I guess, there was a dark match this night. Chris Walker would beat Brooklyn Brawler by DQ. Brawler got the pin with his feet on the ropes, and this brought Jack Tunney out and overruled the ref and reversed the decision. And Meltzer would write, this was done to turn Tunney, easy for me to say, babyface for the live crowd so they wouldn't boo him when he came out for his announcement before the Royal Rumble. It didn't work out since they still booed him like crazy when he came out later in the show, and he gave the match a dud. Why did everybody hate Jack Tunney so much?
Because he was the authority figure, probably because he was Canadian. And in Albany, they just, you know, they're used to the Canadians crossing the border, and that was probably the main reason. But he was the decision maker. He had taken the title off of Hogan, and they looked at him as a heel.
Let me tell you, as a kid, and I guess that's why I love this zapper sound so much, it made me laugh so much, because as a kid, man, I fucking loved the Mountie. I thought the Mountie was one of the best characters ever. Because it was so over the top, and he makes this weird face in all the promo photos. That's just like the forced frown and, just the silly, I'm the Mountie. I don't know why, but it fucking tickled me. And I love the gear. And there's actually a listener of ours, and I forget his name, but he actually went as the Mountie for a Halloween costume one year. And it was the most legit Halloween costume I've ever seen for wrestling.
And Jacques lived it, man. Jacques had heat as a Mountie. Jacques had heat as Jacques, for fuck's sake. But, you know, and here's the difference. The shock stick that they used in WWE was a working shock stick.
Right.
Bill Watts used a cattle prod in Mid-South, and it was a shoot cattle prod. So Bill would come out, and when he was doing the Midnight Rider gimmick, and Bill would actually shock the heels with it just to be an asshole. And there was a guy by the name of Ray Candy who worked as, I don't know. He had some Arab name during that time for the gimmick that they were doing. And Ray told him, he says, Bill, you shock me one more time, it's going to be the last time and I'm gone. And Bill came, you know, laughing and just being big bully Bill, and Bill shocked him, and Ray got up, no-sold it, and said, that was the last time, and walked out of the ring and walked to the back, got in his car, and was never heard from again.
Kareem Muhammad.
Yes.
So there you go.
It's an Arab name, isn't it?
We'll go with that. He was also okay. Black Stud Williams, Commando Ray, Mass Superfly, and Super Mario Man.
and a hell of a nice guy. And just, but the thing was, all Bill had to do was touch him with the guys would have sold the thing, but Bill wanted to actually shock him with the damn cattle prod.
Maybe, his claim to fame is he trained New Jack.
Ray Candy did?
Yep.
Get out of here.
How about that?
Nice guy. Ray Candy's a nice guy. I don't know New Jack, but I'm sure he's a nice guy too. And now Roddy's showing his arsenal of moves with an atomic drop and the wonderful bump over the top rope, skinning the cat. Look at how hard it is. It's been a long time since Jacques did that. And let's go home, folks. Here we go. And the worst sleeper hold in the business right here. I hate when guys put the sleeper on like this. This is what I criticized Chris Jericho about. And then Jericho had to call me and send me a nice little message with an F in it, talking about his sleeper hold.
You think Chris's sleeper hold is the shits?
The one that he had in the match with The Rock that we were talking about, it was the shits. And when guys put on the sleeper hold
Make the noise. Hang on. Here we go. Piper has it. He's stolen it from Jimmy Hart. He's got the shock stick, looking around to the crowd. The crowd's ready for it. He holds it up.
You want me to do it? Yes, you do. I'm going to shock you there. You better get out of the ring there, little Joey Marola. Oh, here I go. Should I do it? Oh, I'm giving him plenty of time to get the cue up. Let me kick his arm here. Oh, yeah. Hold it up like that. Here we go. Two. It's going to be a double shocker. Thumbs down. Here we go.
Can you fucking believe this? I love wrestling. I love wrestling.
Oh, shit.
So silly.
What's so silly about it?
It just
That's
is.
Real,
I
mean, man.
I love it. I love it, but it's silly. And of course, Roddy Piper gets the win. And this is his only belt in the WWF, is it not?
It is. It is. And if I had been there and had any say so in it at all, I would have been against Roddy being the champion.
Even the Intercontinental champion?
Any championship. Didn't need it. I'd hate taking it off of him, well, but it worked and it worked fine.
I guess I shouldn't say this is his only one because he was tag champs with Ric Flair, but I mean, that was so late. I don't even know that we really count that.
Well, that one I was for, I did that one. So that one counts.
If I did it, then it's fine.
Hey, if I did it, then it's good. But in this case, you know,
it did look kind of cool to see him with the title here. I need you to sort of, we do a watch along thing with Tony Schiavone every week, and Tony usually does the voiceovers for the guys. And we're about to see Lord Alfred interview Hulk Hogan. I'm going to need you to freestyle here for me.
Well, Hulk, sir, can I tell you? Well, let me tell you something, Awful Alfred. I forgot what the hell my shit was. It's not going to be sipping tea here tonight, brother. Because Hulkamania is going to be running wild in the Royal Rumble. Yeah. And you and me, if we got to go out and do what we got to do, it's going to be nothing but the Undisputed Championship for the Hulkster tonight, brother. So you go sip your tea and shove it up your goddamn candy ass and let me get through pumping up my damn muscles here, brother. Because I don't do Coliseum video, bro. Even if Tony Schiavone were still here, I would. Do it.
Well, there you go. Good job.
Yeah. I actually see, here's the thing. I had notes for a later Hulk promo. And Bushwhacker Luke and Butch. You see, Butch was damn committed to the Bushwhacker gimmick, and Luke, I think, was just, you know, happy to be there and doing his stuff and being a damn Bushwhacker. And everybody's wondering what the hell Jameson is doing there. Aye, mate. Yeah, Butch had a lot of lines to remember here. And this was probably during a time that they were experimenting with giving them lines during all the promos.
Unfortunately, I can't believe this is real. These motherfuckers are about to wrestle 15 and a half minutes.
Can we just skip over it?
I wish we could. We're going to talk about everything else during this match. They're going to be taking on the Beverly Brothers. And of course, we've got Jameson here, who looks like Pauly Shore's uncle. Who is Jameson? I know we've talked about him before on the show briefly, but a lot of people are probably seeing him for the very first time right now. And my apologies for that.
Well, Jameson was a character actor that Vince saw at a murder mystery dinner theater in Greenwich, Connecticut. Vince loved the character, and like the guy's name was like John Giacomo or something like that. But Vince brought him in for the Bobby Heenan show, and he was going to be the guest or the co-host for the Bobby Heenan show. Jameson came around when the Bobby Heenan show went away. Vince really wanted to keep Jameson on doing something, so he put him with the Bushwhackers. And that's how we got Jameson. But, you know, two guys that don't get a lot of credit, the Beverly Brothers here, Mike Enos and Wayne Bloom. These two guys are products from Minnesota, from the whole Kurt Hennig, Rick Rude, Legion of Doom, Eddie Sharkey School, and all that that came up in Minnesota with that whole crew of a bunch of badasses. And it's funny when you look at Wayne Bloom, who's the more slender of the two. Wayne was probably one of the strongest guys in the business when it came to weightlifting. Wayne Bloom right there. Absolutely incredible power and strength. And I'm the genius, and I can... Oh, wait, he finished, so I can't finish it.
No one cares. If you've got a genius rhyme, let's hear it.
I don't. I don't. That's okay, you're supposed to just go with it, because if I tried to rhyme, I couldn't, so we're going to save some time.
Let me tell you, as a kid,
rhyme with time,
I can appreciate, and I guess I can as an adult, why the Bushwhackers were on the show. I mean, this hand movement is over, the licking the kids, which really does not age well. As a kid, I thought, oh man, these guys are gross. And now as an adult, I'm like, oh fuck. But still, I mean, they're here to entertain the kids. It's almost like, I don't know, the 80s version of Santino Marella, right? They're here to entertain the crowd.
Oof. It's funny when you think of the sheep herders, Luke and Butch, who for years were known for the ultimate violence and the ultimate bloody barbed wire cage matches. These guys were extreme and ECW crap long before anybody had ever heard of ECW. They headlined all over the world and were just nasty top drawing heels. And Vince took one look at them and says, God damn, they're baby faces. You like licking yourself, don't you? Conrad's licking himself, folks.
Well, I heard that the Mountie could. No, not the Mountie. I'm sorry. The Genius. I heard the Genius.
Well, you just
could.
Did, and I saw it. I've never seen the Genius do it. I just saw you do it.
Well, spread that around.
Whoa! Yay!
Will that be the noise you would make if you really could lick yourself? Whoa!
Yay! I spend a lot more time in my office.
I guess it's worth mentioning what we're about to watch here. This silly horse shit. One, the worst match of the night poll in a landslide. Here's what Meltzer had to say about it as far as his critique. This is pretty fun. This match was so long and so bad, it would give most shows a thumbs down all by itself. That's not even considering Jameson. The only thing bearable was the commentary, since they never talked about the match and just concentrated on comedy with Heenan ranking on Jameson. But after the commentary, the best thing about the match was all the missed moves. The next best thing was the Bushwhackers licking each other and marching around the ring. Predictably, after the match was over, the Bushwhackers chased the Beverlys from the ring and held the Genius so Jameson can kick him in the shin and the butt. Earlier in the match, Genius had slapped Jameson. At least Jameson plays his ultra nerd role well. And to Titan's credit, their non-humorous attempt at comedy with Jameson at least was put in a match where it couldn't make it much worse. Negative star and a half.
Yeah, but watch Butch lick Luke. Good shit. God damn it. I love it. But they're putting their time in here.
This feels like
get that time in.
Feels like a George South match right now. They're going to do 20 minutes of this before the bell rings.
Well, yeah, because they got 21 minutes to for a match and everything. So if you can kill 20 of it here, why not?
It is worth mentioning, Meltzer loved the show. He wrote, This year's Royal Rumble was certainly one of the WWF's best pay-per-view shows ever. I gave it a thumbs up without any question. The undercard was a slight thumbs down, but the Rumble itself was more than enough to change that. I thought overall as a show, last year's Rumble from a wrestling content and excitement perspective was significantly better, and I still rank last year's Rumble as the best WWF pay-per-view show in recent years. However, last year's show, with them exploiting the war so heavy-handedly, left a bad aftertaste. This year's Royal Rumble match itself was a lot better than last year's, and the match itself didn't have a strong undercard and was somewhat anticlimactic. But it seems the majority opinion from the messages thus far is that this is one of the best WWF pay-per-view shows since at least last year's Rumble. I mean, that match is so good, the main event, that I think it makes up for all this, but this was a fucking chore to get through this week for me, man. I can't lie.
Yeah, and I got to agree with you. I just, again, I'm looking at it from a producer's point of view and a promoter's heart, looking at trying to get where you need to go, where you need to be. Yeah, it was a one match show, and you had to go, oh my God, the double sledgehammers and Luke Selling coming off of his knees is absolutely classic. It's, oh boy.
Let's talk a little bit about Hulk Hogan and Ric Flair. I didn't realize this until I started to do my research for the show here, but they actually ran a show in Honolulu in front of 18,000 fans where Flair beat Hogan by count out. I was really fascinated by that. How was business in Hawaii as a whole? I've never really heard us talk about Hawaii much.
As a whole, generally, Hawaii would be the drizzling shits. And that's why they really only ran it maybe once a year. If there was a good reason to run it, like a overseas tour in Japan or Far East, just if it was on the way. Because on its own, Hawaii never drew. And Liam Avila used to try and do tours and used to try and do big shows in between the Japanese tours with Baba and those guys, when guys would stop over in Hawaii and she'd say, hey, why don't you stay for a couple of days and run a big show with as many big stars as they could. But as a rule, never really drew.
The day after Christmas, Hogan beat Flair by DQ in Hershey, and the same day they ran in Landover and Hogan beat Flair by count out there. The next day they're in Richmond, Virginia, a market where they hadn't drawn more than $40,000 for years, and they drew $107,000. The crowd here was super pro Flair, and they even teased the title switch with Flair beating Hogan for the title before they did the Dusty finish. They drew $107,000 though, so like 2.5 times as much. Outstanding. On the 29th, they ran Madison Square Garden and Hogan beat Flair again by count out. That's a famous poster that a lot of us have seen in the collector market. The January 5th meeting between the two happened at the Omni in Atlanta. And check this out. It only drew 4,500 fans. And I guess it's worth mentioning that WCW had ran multiple shows there very recently, and they did it with $3 tickets. I assume it's probably hard to get people to pay for wrestling if they've grown accustomed to $3 tickets, but it feels like Hulk Hogan and Ric Flair in Atlanta should have been a hell of a house. Why do you think it only drew 4,500 fans?
Well, I think because of the reason you just said, when the hometown promoter, and that for that era, NWA and WCW would have been the hometown promoter in Atlanta. And when they start giving their product away, that sets the value of professional wrestling in their market. So it would be tough to come in and battle that, because I guarantee you on the heels of WWE announcing that they're going to have a show there and their ticket prices coming out, that NWA would be right behind that with, hey, don't go to that, because in however many days, a week or 2 weeks, we're coming in and our tickets are only $3. So for you to take a family of four is what it would cost for one person to go to a WWE event. And that's how they promoted it. That's what we did. I mean, we never gave our stuff away. Bill Watts used to give free shows away and do dollar tickets and things like that in Tulsa to combat the WWE back in the day. But once people get used to that, they're not going to pay top dollar. At least it takes a while to get the audience back.
So when they come out of here, they've got a new plan for house shows going forward. At least that's what Meltzer reports at the time. that it's going to be Hogan and Piper against Taker and Flair. That's sort of a weird hodgepodge of dudes there, is it not?
It's star power. It's throw as much. It's names, you know, put names up there. You're going to see Hulk Hogan, Roddy Piper, Ric Flair, and Undertaker all in one match. That's what they're doing. And they're just trying to flood it with names. And it's not necessarily the match that's selling it.
The January 6th show in Miami saw Hogan over Flair by count out on top. The January 7th show in Dayton saw Sherry announce that she was in love with Sean. And this is when Sid Justice returned on January 7th. And there was a dark match again of Hogan over Flair once again by count out. Freestyle a guess as to why you think Sid was back here.
Softball season's over.
I was hoping you were going to say that.
Well, wasn't it?
On January 9th, they're running Sarasota. And here they've got Bret Hart beating Ric Flair by DQ with 2,500 fans there. Allegedly, Hart had the sharpshooter on and Flair poked the ref in the eyes, but it got good reviews all around. January 11th, they're going to have nearly 13,000 folks on hand to see Hogan beat Flair by count out. And there's $170,000 at the gate. So it's drawing really well here again. But of that show, what everyone was talking about was the Rockers angle that aired over the weekend on Challenge. And you probably remember which one we're talking about there, don't you, Bruce?
Brutus the Beefcake Barber and the barber shop. And that's where Shawn Michaels finally got rid of the dead weight of Marty Jannetty and put his ass through a barbershop window.
Well, what's great is when Bobby Heenan says, "Oh, he jumped through the window. I knew he was going to do that," or something like that. So
look,
good.
He's trying to get away from Shawn.
I mean, one of the most iconic angles of all time, and it's happening right around this show. Meltzer would write at the time, quote, "Expect a big Sid to turn heel this year. Probably not far into the year either." Now, Sid always wanted to be heel. Did he not?
Yeah. Sid thought that, you know, Vince saw Sid as the ultimate babyface, and Vince saw Sid as the replacement for Hulk Hogan. Sid saw Sid as the big nasty heel and that he should be like Bob Holly, win the title and beat everybody. So that was his mindset, and this was an opportunity for Sid to come back, be the big, mean, nasty heel, and get that match with Hulk Hogan at WrestleMania.
January 12th in Hamilton, Ontario, we've got Hogan over Flair by countout again. And then 2 days before this show is the Springfield show we just referenced, where we saw Flair beat Piper by countout. It's also where the Mountie won the Intercontinental title. And on that show, I can't believe this happened, Hulk Hogan pinned Jake the Snake Roberts in 6.5 minutes. We almost never saw that match, so it's kind of fun that it happened here. But it was an accident because Hogan was subbing for Savage. I know we've talked about him before, but why don't you think Hogan and Roberts worked more often?
Well, I don't know. The only thing that I can really think of is back in the day when Jake first came in with that snake, the snake got such a pop that you're battling, you know, and you're battling the big baby face in Hogan, and then you're battling the baby face that was the snake in the bag. To me, I thought that Jake and Hogan would have been huge money. I think that the whole Jake the Snake gimmick and the evil promos that Jake could have cut and the babyface promos that Hogan could have cut, take Damien out of it and only bring him out when you need it. I thought that could have been big money. I can't answer that. I don't know.
I've been covering, you know, this Hogan Flair stuff because we're going to talk about it. But the night before, and this is another record, they're in Boston and they draw a legit sellout of 15,000 fans, which Meltzer writes is the first sellout of a big building for a non-pay-per-view card from either group in so many months that I've lost track. And what drew it, of course, Flair and Hogan on top. No surprise, I guess. I mean, it looks like that's what we're heading for here. In this show, I guess we should talk about too, you know, after this show is over with, there's still going to be lots of rumor and innuendo about what was next and what was coming. Meltzer would write in the February 3rd edition of the newsletter, "The top two spots for WrestleMania seem to be finalized as Hulk Hogan versus Sid Justice and Ric Flair versus Randy Savage for the WWF title. The change from the originally planned Hogan-Flair title match changed sometime in early January, and one can speculate as to why. Bottom line is that if they were going to do Hogan-Flair, that would mean a title change, and one questioned the business sense of that title change, given that Hogan would be taking 5 months off to do a movie, and there are a lot of other questions regarding Hogan's future in wrestling. So all these years later, man, everybody's got a different reason for why we didn't see that match. You know, JJ Dillon says it didn't draw like we hoped it might. And Rick has even said, I wasn't a big draw on the West Coast. And everybody's got these different reasons, but realistically, if you were going to do it, you had to have Hogan go over. But if Hogan goes over with your title belt and he's gone for 5 months, that's not something that you did in this era, right?
Well, no, it's not. But at the same time, it didn't draw. And it didn't draw outside of traditional WWE territories in that Northeast and where the WWE was historically really strong. So they didn't feel that putting anything into it. But my counter to that was, this is years later, this is Monday morning quarterbacking, was that I didn't feel that they did anything on television between Hulk and Rick that was of a personal nature to make you care about the match, other than you're relying on Rick's run as an NWA world champion and hoping that your audience is going to know that. And just based on reputation alone, a lot of there were people that were just true blue WWF fans that only knew WWF and didn't know NWA, didn't care and or know who Ric Flair was. So to them, he was brand new. He was claiming a championship that they didn't know anything about. So it was, they never did anything to make it mean something.
I guess it's worth mentioning that Flair's going to defend the title the very next night, the night after this show in Montreal. And it's going to be Hogan and Flair on top. Hogan's going to beat him by count out, and they draw almost 11,000 there in Montreal. It really is a good drawing deal, but as you said, one of those things. The following week, though, on February 10th, we would see in the Observer that Meltzer says it's pretty apparent what WrestleMania 8 is going to look like. Hogan Justice, Flair Savage, Taker Roberts, Piper Hart. And he writes, while not even hinted at as of yet, there are rumors flying that the tag team title match will send Legion of Doom versus Ted DiBiase and IRS, who are going to form a new heel tag team. IRS is replacing Shawn Michaels, who was originally to team with DiBiase, but that idea has apparently been scrapped for reasons of which I have no idea. Don't have the exact figures yet, but believe the number of tickets sold for the Hoosier Dome card is already more than 15,000. Did you remember hearing any sort of rumor and innuendo about a DiBiase Shawn Michaels tag team?
That is actually the first time I've ever heard that.
Well,
never heard that. Kind of like we didn't hear the three count here in the Beverly Brothers finally ending this match that we've been talking over. But you know what happens at the end of the match here with the Bushwhackers?
What's that?
The Bushwhackers must eat sardines. I don't know, but you got the heels that went over, and now the baby faces are finally making an offensive comeback, and God awful doesn't even begin to justify it. So
there you go. Not a great show so far. Do you want to have fun with this Jameson interaction here?
I love the way that he gets his butt up here, getting underneath the ropes, trying to get in. I thought it was pretty good classic. And here he had taken lessons earlier from Shawn Michaels with the sweet shin music. He takes a lesson and he holds his fist kind of like somebody else that I know and love way back when, but it could be some of the worst, but people ate it up. People loved it. And should I do it? Should I do it? Yeah, in the shin. And I don't know what the hell happened to his shoes, but you notice he's only got one shoe on.
Yeah, one came off.
Oh, damn. That's a shame. Well, one of them was gimmicked so that the bottom, the sole was flapping all the time, and he had to tape that up because he couldn't walk with it. And it was great when he does his community theater, but not great for being in the ring.
Oh, yay!
It comes out around this time that Hawk was missing some house shows, and Animal was working as a singles. Can you venture a guess as to why?
He overslept.
Okay, we'll go with that. Speaking of oversleeping, around this same time, superstar Billy Graham and David Schultz were doing an Inside Edition and 2020 appearance. And of course, they're talking about Dr. Zahorian, Hulk Hogan, anabolic steroids. And both of these guys are making claims and providing documentation that a lot of the other guys in the business will back up. But the word on the street was that Billy Graham was really trying to extort $1.25 million from the WWE in order to sort of make all this go away. Even Meltzer was saying that Hogan had really become a scapegoat in all this. What were you hearing about all this from the outside?
Just, you know, a lot of nonsense, and everybody was looking for something. I think everybody was looking for some kind of angle to get some kind of money out of the WWE and expose whatever it is that they felt they wanted to expose and get their 15 minutes of fame.
Of course, on screen right now, we've got a promo from the Legion of Doom. There's always a handful of things that I remember from these: The Well, What a Rush, and Tell 'Em Hawk. Are those your favorite go-tos of these promos?
Well, what a rush. You want to throw your weight around? Well, that's okay, because we want to throw your weight around too. And that's exactly what we're going to do. What a rush.
I loved Hawk's promos. And Mike was responsible for so many guys, just gimmicks, promos, catchphrases from Paul Bearer, Doink the Clown, just shit like that, that he would come up with stuff. One of the most entertaining guys I've ever had the pleasure of being around. Not everybody got along with him. I was fortunate. I had a blast with him, and I had a good time with Hawk.
I feel like we should mention here that Meltzer did run a correction regarding Bret Hart. He says, quote, "The word we received at press time regarding Hart going to WCW was incorrect, and that by the time we wrote it, the deal was temporarily dead. Hart is under contract to the WWF. His earliest out would be in September, unless WCW and Hart attempt to void his contract, which isn't going to happen. Hart was offered $300,000 as a guarantee to make the jump, and had agreed to it until realizing his WWF contract had rolled over. I could be wrong, but my gut feeling is that Hart will get a big push and the WWF will attempt to keep him come the fall rather than be buried." Oh, obviously they did. But did you ever have a conversation with Brad about what life might have been like had he went here in 92?
No, you know, I never knew that Brett had done that until many, many years later, after the fact, after Brett had left. And it wasn't something, you know, that, at least from my vantage point, that I really knew. So it wasn't something to talk about. And I think by that time, Brett was happy until he wasn't happy. But, you know, it's just kind of is what it is. And Dave getting out ahead of himself, and that kind of tells you where he's getting his information and from what side. When we were talking about at the very beginning, I had talked to Roddy Piper, and Piper had pretty much laid out the plans in a very general form of where they were going all the way through WrestleMania, and that Brett wasn't going down south. So there you go. I mean, I guess it just kind of depends on where you get your information. And you know, it always, this is another thing kind of amazes me. You look at the screen right here, and that's four of the just badasses of badasses.
Yep.
In one ring at one time that you will ever see. I mean, you got Hawk and Animal, you got John Tenta and Earl Hebner. And I mean, that's just four badasses right there.
And then Hebner.
Well, I said Hebner.
I know. I'm just saying four badasses.
I left Typhoon out. Yeah. Okay.
Meltzer would write, "Natural Disasters beat Legion of Doom by count out. So Doom keeps the tag titles in 9:27. Quote, "This was actually the best match I've seen these four have, but says more about how bad the other matches have been. but it was okay until the cheap finish where everyone was brawling on the floor and Typhoon got in to beat the count. With all the time they spent on booking the rest of the card, they must have spent the time it takes between bites of a roast beef sandwich to come with this finish. Star and a half. I got to tell you, as a kid, I dug both of these because it was believable to me that these natural disasters, who were monsters, could actually oppose the Legion of Doom. And I think we've talked about this before on the show. I grew up having seen Demolition first. So I was sort of in your camp where I thought, you know, the Legion of Doom was, they were the late adopters. They were the copycats, unlike, you know, what a lot of other people believe. But as a result, I kind of always dug this red and black version of LOD that I know a lot of hardcore JCP fans think is almost sacrilege. You're supposed to like the black and the silver spikes. Did you have a preference one way or other? Did you think that maybe the better days were behind the LOD here in 92, or what was your take?
No, I didn't. And I thought that this match was laid out perfectly, and it was a great story. It told a great story of two huge teams. And what Monsoon say, the immovable object meets the impenetrable force, or whatever the hell it is. They told a great story in this match of two big badass teams colliding together. The count out finish, it's a cheap finish to get you to the next step without having to beat anybody really. But the story itself and seeing Hawk sell and some of Bobby Heenan's lines were just, you know, right here, he talks about how Hawk is a bird of prey. Well, he better start praying for help right about now. And just those little one-liners that Heenan had all the way through the damn thing made the match even more memorable. But the way they worked, it felt real. And as a spectator, even 30 years later, you can sit there and go, God damn, that was good shit.
It was good stuff. And I'm a big fan of these guys. And I got to tell you, the kid in me thought it was the coolest thing ever when Road Warrior Animal went out of his way to come to our show in New Orleans. You know, he came out very early when we were sort of joking that when they announced our network show at Hall of Fame, that we got a Road Warrior pop. And when he came out, man, he really did get a Road Warrior pop. That crowd was ready. And just seeing, and I know that I'm an adult and I'm grown and this shouldn't be cool, but just seeing Road Warrior Animal in his face paint, man, that's like the shit I grew up on. That was awesome.
Exactly. When they came out here in the Royal Rumble, when you compare everything, they got a something else to wrestle with pop when they came out for this match here. So what?
Nothing. I'm good. I'm good.
I'm just saying that was kind of pretty cool. And, you know, Bobby Heenan had the comment about Animal's haircut, you know, just it's a great haircut if you're going to the chair. But one-liners just kind of continued, which is why you have to go back and listen to this with Heenan's commentary, as well as our horrible commentary that we're doing on it is, you know, well, you know.
I feel like we should mention here that not too terribly long after Jim Herd was fired in WCW, people start really talking, and Herd was fired around this time. And of course he had that infamous falling out, not 6 months prior, with Ric Flair that brought him to the WWF with the big gold belt. And Meltzer wrote, while there has been much talk within the company of regaining Flair over the past week, our reports indicate Flair has an ironclad 2-year contract with Titan Sports through September 1993. Well, of course, we know that they would work out a deal where Flair could return quote unquote home sooner than that. But it had to be something that the company was at least concerned about, with Jim Herd being really the primary function of Ric Flair coming up, and all his friends are down there, and that's more of his comfortable place. Do you think there was any concern that Flair may try to want to leave here, or was the honeymoon not over with the company just yet?
I don't think the honeymoon was over yet, because Rick hadn't experienced being the champion yet. So I think to Rick being the champion here, that really did mean something to him. And he hadn't experienced that yet. He was still on the honeymoon. He's still on top. And, you know, man, the good stuff hadn't even kicked in yet.
I feel like we should mention here that, and this is good stuff. There's an incident that happened with the Nasty Boys, and we're going to see the Nasties in a little while, but this is from the January 20th, 1992 edition of the Observer. And I know you get mad when I quote it, but it's available at WrestlingObserver.com. The Nasty Boys are now expected to be out of action for a few weeks after that incident in Peoria, Illinois. Newspaper reports said that the wrestlers, the Nasty Boys and IRS, told police they were driving to their hotel when suspects in a Chevy Chevette cut them off. They said the suspects threw something that struck their car while it was stopped at a light. Knobs got out of the car to check for damage at the light and was attacked by three of the men, all of whom have since been arrested. When Sags jumped out to help, he was hit in the head with jumper cables and suffered a concussion. The wrestlers said they were able to get a knife from one of the suspects and were going to hold him until the police came, but released him when they realized Knobs was losing a lot of blood from being stabbed four times and needed immediate medical attention. The three men had a different story. They said Knobs was stabbed in self-defense. They told police the wrestlers were making obscene gestures and pointing at them, and they said Knobs got out of the car at the light, opened the car door, and punched one of the guys 10 times. The guy then grabbed the knife from the dashboard and stabbed Knobs four times, and the men gave no account of hitting Sags with jumper cables, although Sags was hospitalized with a 2-inch cut on his head. The three victims, picked up an hour after the incident, were uninjured, which kind of makes everyone skeptical of the story that they were acting in self-defense. Man, what a story here. Had you heard this before? And what was the rumor mill at the time about this Nasty Boys at a red light?
Well, the rumor mill was, you know, one of an altercation, right, but that, you know, these guys had jumped them and that, Knobs had gotten stabbed. All right. I never heard, you just said the IRS was in the car, which to me, the reality base in this situation was that had this not happened pretty damn quick, that I think that IRS, Mike Rotunda, who is one of the baddest human beings, probably still walking the face of the earth, a legit shooter and tough guy, that wouldn't have happened. You know what I mean? If they had gotten out and had jumped them, and especially if Rotunda was involved, that would have been a scary situation. And I think there's probably, I don't even know if the truth meets in the middle in that one, but the boy's story sounds a little bit more plausible to me than the other story. Cause as you say, the guys show up, when they finally get them, there's no marks on them and nothing. And if Knobs hit you 10 times, you'd have some marks somewhere. And if IRS got his hands on you, you'd have a few broken bones everywhere. Dang.
What a match here these guys are having. John Tenta, one of the more underrated performers in the business. We've had him on the poll a few times. He did not win the most recent poll where he was up there with the Big Boss Man, The Rock, and I forget what else. Oh, In Your House, Cold Day in Hell. But hopefully we get to cover Earthquake another time. I had these action figures as a kid for all the guys, and I've always hated Earthquake, man. He nearly killed Hulkamania.
And he did squash Damien the Snake.
It's just a bad deal, man. It's a bad deal.
It is. But if I were these guys, I would mind the count, because that's what you have to do, Conrad. When you're on the outside of the ring, you have to mind the damn count. And you have to be just conscious of where the hell the referee is in his count at all times. And I especially like how Tenta was really kind and took Animal back to the mat before he slammed him slammed him down. It's a very considerate thing for him to do. But there you go. They minded the count and got in before the referee reached that 10 count. And there you go. That's a damn creative and great finish. In other words, fuck Dave Meltzer.
In other words, your boy Pat Patterson probably booked it.
Pat was probably too busy on the Rumble to worry about this.
Man, how about those taking care of everybody chair shots?
Yeah. He definitely did that. That's for damn sure.
I mean, I'm not mad at it. Good for
I'm
him.
Not mad at it either. I'm just saying he definitely did. Thank I is a talent. I would appreciate that. You know, the other thing that really amazed me here, and for whatever reason, I don't know why, but you go back to early Road Warriors and you watch them. I always remember Animal being the slow, methodical one. Man, he's moving like a son of a bitch in these matches.
Yeah.
just quick and just lighthearted. And holy cow, I really didn't recall all that.
Yeah, what a rush.
But these are the days, you know, of the pay-per-view and taking time out in the middle. Why? I think it was still, you know, going back to the closed circuit and having to give intermissions and giving people time. And you know, they don't even do intermissions anywhere anymore. And this was one of my favorite interviews on the whole damn night. Well, Sean Mooney here.
By the way, how great is Sean Mooney?
I love Sean Mooney. And what a singing voice, too. Helping Pat Patterson out with My Way at our live show, you got to love. And the natural disasters taking a little while to get backstage for this damn promo. And let me tell you something, Sean. Yeah. Good stuff. Good stuff. But also right here, you see the camera is going to shoot off of the set. And you realize that, hey, we're not really inside of a locker room here. That's a set up there with lights backlit. That would never happen on my watch, by God.
Yeah, it did. It was the only time that I remember seeing you guys make that mistake where it wasn't so tight. Of course, an extra foot of that would have made it better, but the set was hilarious to me because as a kid, I mean, I bought into it, hook, line, and sinker. I dug it.
Well, of course you did, except when you look at the size of the lockers, and I don't even think that Earthquake could get his hand inside one of those lockers, and I always loved the payphone in the background. You know, Jimmy Hart was just absolutely underrated with everything he did, and you can't just discount a wonderful Earthquake here. Time's up, but he's still going.
Ah, the Ellie Earthquake.
I don't know why every time I want to do a heel, it turns into either one of the Road Warriors, usually Mike.
Why is that?
I don't know. It just seems simple. Just so damn heelish. Capacity crowd here, brain. You got to love Gorilla with his brown glasses, his velvet coat. And you know, that had to be just hotter than shit in there.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah. But Bobby talking about, you know, Bobby throughout this whole damn thing, again, we can't stress it enough. Let's just go back to listen to Bobby. And now, oh, here I am. There you go, me, Gene. I got me a new belt right here. Got me their continental title. Don't really want it. Don't know why the hell they gave it to me. Because eventually Vince is going to come in. He's going to say, Hot Rod, you got to drop the son of a bitch. I just don't really want to do that. Not at all. Because you see, I'm Hot Rod Roddy Piper. And I don't do a whole lot of jobs kind of like tonight. That's why I got the belt here. But now you got to figure out what the hell you want to do about it there. It's time for you to have to pay the piper, if you will. Somebody give me the cue to go home and kiss my ass. Well, right now you're going to hear from everybody that is anybody here on the Royal Rumble. Guys, I can't wait for this one. This is the ultimate Royal Rumble. Sean Mooney here. I don't know why I'm still talking like Gene Okerlund, but I love that the Barbarian gets a little cameo here and he walks right by. And I don't know why in the hell they didn't reveal this mirror over here that Shawn Michaels has been looking at this whole time. And I like the nice little camera move over. But Sean being referred to as an underdog in 1992 at the Royal Rumble.
How fun is that?
Well, you got to love it because, you know, Sean talks about, you know, heinous acts and that everybody's talking about the heinous act that we talked about a little bit earlier on tonight on the Beefcake, the Barber, Brutus set right here. Your favorite moment in time. Now, if you watch it real close, you're going to see Sean just goes to stretch here a little bit. Tells Marty, move while I stretch. And then Marty walks right back in while Sean's trying to stretch and falls down.
Shame.
So Sean goes over to help him up, being the nice tag team partner that he is. Says, hey, Marty, you okay? Here, let me help you up, buddy. And then watch Marty just run away from him and dive through the window. It's amazing.
It is weird.
It is kind of weird. And Sean goes on to, you know, talked about the fact that Marty Jannetty won't be in the Royal Rumble, but look at it on the positive light. Sean has just saved Marty from 29 heinous beatings that he would have to endure if he were indeed the in the Royal Rumble itself. Now, the other thing that I don't get is coming right off of this, that we go to a Coliseum video interview. Now, this is not a Coliseum video. I think this was actually part of the real show itself. But just in the middle of things, we go back to Lord Alfred Hayes coming up here. I know I'm way ahead of it, folks. And there's your boy, the Nature Boy, Ric Flair, who now takes all the drama out of everything and says, yeah, that's right. I drew number three. I'm going to be the third one in the Royal Rumble. But it's also fascinating here that Rick ends this thing with, and that's the bottom line, from the Nature Boy, Ric Flair.
Isn't that fun?
You got to love it. You got to love it. If you're going to steal from the best, and you know, what's old is new again. And in about 10 years, it'll all be brand new all over again.
It's a pretty fun deal that we've got here. And I guess this match, you know, or this pay-per-view rather, had a couple of Coliseum exclusives. We saw the Hulk Hogan interview, and then there's the Ric Flair one, but I agree. It does sort of take away. Of course, that interview wasn't in the original pay-per-view live version, but it does sort of give a little bit of a spoiler, because Bobby Heenan's going to lose his fucking mind when he draws number three in a minute.
Exactly. And I think everybody else, you know, is going to lose their mind now as Gene just throws generically to everybody. Oh yeah. Freak out, because the Macho Man is going to be back at the top of the mountain. And there's two things I'm looking for tonight. That's a snake and a championship. And a snake is going to be easy to find. Freak out. Dig it. Uh-huh. Oh, yeah. Macho Man is coming at you. Uh-huh. Coming for you to be number one. Macho Man Randy Savage just keeps saying words about two things. Uh-huh. Peace out, brother. Uh-huh. Because it's getting a little bit freaky in here. Thank God for Sid Justice. Oh, yeah. Uh-huh. I don't know why I'm grinding my teeth and talking like this, because I am the ruler of the world. And if I grind like this and I get just pissed off because I think I'm the smartest man in the wrestling business, then you Hulk Hogan and everyone else will know I'm Sid Justice, and my teeth do not move ever.
Hey, I don't know why I'm whispering, but Sid was kind of whispering in the promo before, so I'm going to whisper too, because I'm the Repo Man and I'm going to steal your shit. And you got to remember, what's mine is mine. What's yours is mine too. And I'm wearing a fucking mask around my eyes, but I used to be Demolition. And now I'm wearing the shit with the tread, got tire treads on my shoulder. The Road Warriors get like cool pads and shit. I should get a crappy old duster.
A fortune one even there, and I'd like to fortune thank everyone for fortune coming out. I'm number 41, and a fortune all I want to talk about is the fortune Royal Albert Fortune Hall that I was fortune in a while ago. That was the fortune greatest night of my fortune life at the Royal Fortune Albert Hall, when I fortune felt fortune royalty. Now I'm fortune going to do it again with the fortune Royal Rumble, because I fortune, I want to do like this, because I fortune can only remember the fortune Royal Albert Hall, and I'm the British Bulldog, and I'm going to win the fortune belt. Own one there, I swear.
You know, I don't do a really good Jake, but I always like that Jake started this out with one of my favorite songs. You know, my man, you can't always get what you want.
But tonight, I'm going to get what I need. And Randy Savage, got something really special for you. Trust me or don't trust me. But you never, ever trust a snake. And I'm a snake. I'm a sneaky snake. That's why they call me Jake the Snake, because I'm a sneaky snake. And that should be a fucking song. Trust me.
When you have sports mixed with your pop culture, along with humor and celebrity interviews, your earbuds are enjoying the Rich Eisen Show.
Kevin Millar, we're all paying rent in Ohtani's world, right?
And the Dodgers world. Game is healthy. Game is good. And, you know, I get asked a lot, is that good for baseball? Yeah, it's good for baseball. This is definitely the team to beat, because that should be your next correction, Richie, is this World Series a bust for the Dodgers and Dave Roberts?
Hell yeah.
Search for the Rich Eisen Show on YouTube or wherever you listen.